we're approaching a time of patriotic celebrations in our country. Next Sunday, June 14th, is Flag Day. And a couple of weeks after that is the 4th of July, a time set aside to celebrate the birth of our nation. On that date, 244 years ago, a group of brave men signed a document declaring independence from England. One war later, we had ourselves a new country, the United States of America. I suspect everyone zoomed in here today is, as I am, proud to be an American and grateful to our founding fathers for their courage and wisdom in laying the foundation for what was then a unique experiment in government. Ours is a country rooted in high ideals. It was to be a classless society where everyone was equal under the law with equal opportunity to grow and prosper. Justice and liberty were the bywords of the day. We were free from tyranny and free to worship as we pleased. It was an exciting, heady adventure in governing this new democracy. Amazingly, nearly 2.5 centuries later, our country is still here, battered and worse for wear, perhaps, but still intact. We've survived a horrific civil war, economic depressions and recessions, world wars and cold wars, natural disasters, and growing pains. At the present moment, we're battling a debilitating pandemic, possible economic collapse, and race riots and unrest. Obviously, it hasn't always been easy. Actually, in truth, it's never been easy, but ours is a good system, worth the hard work. Our country requires conscientious citizens willing to think clearly and act responsibly in order to survive. If too many of us become complacent or self-centered and unwilling to make informed, hard decisions, we could lose our greatness. The United States could even cease to be with this grand experiment of our founding fathers, ending in disaster. So we as United States citizens have a big responsibility to get it right. We need to take our civic obligations seriously. Yet as important as that is, we who are Christians have it even harder, because no matter how much we love our country, we love God more. We may pledge allegiance to the United States of America, and we should, but our first allegiance is and always will be to the God of the universe, our Creator and Savior. We find ourselves in this world, smack dab in the middle of what is often called the greatest country on earth, and we are lucky, but we can't lose our focus. We can't be blinded by stars and stripes in our eyes, nor can we be deafened by patriotic rhetoric. This isn't our home. We're only passing through. We may have our marching orders to make this the very best place we can while we're here, but we're bound for glory. We are subjects of the King of Kings, the Lord Most High. Our first loyalty is to Him. So how do we go about the business of being good United States citizens, working hard to make our country the best it can be, and yet keeping our sights firmly set on God? That's what I want to talk about this morning. We can see why this is so important when we consider that God Himself is truth, and He is in each of us. Consequently, we must seek truth in every aspect of our lives. When we resist truth or lie, we are denying Him, thereby diminishing His presence in us. It is that serious. So where to start in figuring out the behavior as Christians, as good citizens? I always like to make sure we're all on the same page of the dictionary by understanding important terms that we'll be using. Let's begin with something very basic, the word government. It almost seems too elementary to need defining, but I'm not so sure it is. I hear people referring to the government as if it were an evil force with its own power unleashed among us. Maybe it almost seems that way sometimes, but it isn't. The word government has several nuances of meaning, but basically it is the political direction and control exercised over the actions and affairs of the members of communities, societies, or states, and the people who administer the control. In the United States, rather than having a dictator or a monarch, we practice representative democracy. So the people who administer our form of government are elected, or are appointed or hired by our elected officials. The truth is that government is absolutely necessary to the existence of a civilized society. We need centralized structure. If we didn't have someone or a group of someone's coordinating our infrastructure, creating and enforcing our laws, protecting our citizenry, and providing for our general well-being, we'd have chaos. We've seen enough hints of that this week to know we want better. Basically, in our country, we have some people working for all the people. Does it always come together perfectly? Of course not. Remember, I said government is made up of people. But it is our responsibility to keep an eye on these people who make up our government so it will run as smoothly, as fairly, and as honestly as possible. That's where elections come in, and we're about to have a big one. We are United States citizens, and Christian women and men have a responsibility to try to get it right. The Bible has a few things to say about our role as citizens, but on the whole, we're left to work out our response to current events using fundamental Christian principles, keeping in mind that even though our 21st century world is a long way away from ancient Palestine, what God expects from us is timeless. However, one thing is apparent in both Old and New Testaments. God insists it is the duty of government to seek justice. In Jeremiah 22, 1 through 3, we read, God's orders, go to the royal palace and deliver this message. Say, listen to what God says, O King of Judah, you who sit on David's throne, you and your officials and all the people who go in and out of these palace gates. This is God's message. Attend to matters of justice. Set things right between people. Rescue victims from their exploiters. Don't take advantage of the homeless, the orphans, the widows. Stop the murdering. The Old Testament law of Moses saw justice as a complex entity comprised of criminal justice and distributive justice, the latter divided into laws about fairness and laws about giving aid to the needy. We know that Jesus preaches over and over again the importance of helping the needy. He enjoins us to love our neighbors, to hate sin, but love our enemies, to do unto others as we would want them to do unto us, and to be an example of Christ to a fallen world. But what about our relationship to government? In 1 Peter 2, 11 through 17, we read, Friends, this world is not your home, so don't make yourselves cozy in it. Don't indulge your ego at the expense of your soul. Live an exemplary life among the natives so that your actions will refute their prejudices. Then they'll be won over to God's side and be there to join in the celebration when he arrives. Make the master proud of you by being good citizens. Respect the authorities, whatever their level. They are God's emissaries for keeping order. It is God's will that by doing good, you might cure the ignorance of the fools who think you're a danger to society. Exercise your freedom by serving God, not by breaking the rules. Treat everyone you meet with dignity. Love your spiritual family. Revere God. Respect the government. It would seem that human systems of government are God's method of securing certain purposes. A just government should provide and protect a framework for good people to lead peaceful, productive lives. To do so, a system of laws, enforcement, and punishments needs to exist If we want to enjoy the benefits of such a system of protection and laws, we have to be willing to accept the obligations and responsibilities such a system requires. It provides a bedrock for the important task of securing justice for all, God's earthly goal for us. We like to call ourselves a Christian nation. In truth, the Founding Fathers were not purposefully laying out a Christian blueprint. Many of them were deists or non-believers. They were, however, trying to establish a nation where anyone could practice his or her religion in peace. Yet, in spite of whether they intended a Christian nation or not, the reality is that the virtues that they incorporated into the foundation of our country are very Christian in origin. Truth, justice, mercy, freedom, equality, rights of the individual. Every one of these ideals came straight out of the pages of the New Testament and were a part of the religious and cultural mindset of the Western world in the 18th century. So if we are in truth a Christian nation, we should hold these ideals high and act on them. It's up to us as Christian citizens and voters to perpetuate them and keep them in the forefront of public consciousness. That being said, we also have a duty to resist trying to turn all of our Christian beliefs into laws binding on all citizens, Christians and non-Christians alike. There is a difference between forbidding acts we all agree damage others, like murder and theft, and forbidding acts that we perceive as displeasing to God. I'm afraid this can get a little tricky. We are mindful that we are Christians, Christ's representatives here on earth, yet we also have to be mindful that we can't legislate the human heart. In the not-so-distant past, Christians pushed through legislation outlawing the sale of alcoholic beverages, closing businesses on Sunday, forbidding married women to teach children, to name a few examples. How many of us even give these things a second thought nowadays? Do you ever get exercised because your child has a married woman teacher? A quick check would even verify that some of you are married women teachers. Is there anyone here who could claim that they've never been out to lunch after church on a Sunday? Did you even feel guilty? But how about forbidding gay marriage, fretting about transgender people in bathrooms, or outlawing abortion? We're getting personal here. It's not always easy for a Christian to know what to do. So how do we go about finding the right answers, doing the right thing, while honoring our Christian values and obligations? I think the very first place to start is not to immediately assume we know the answer and then snap our mind shut like a bear trap. Obviously, there are sometimes occasions when the answer is clear. Solving the excess population problem by sending everyone over 65 into the wilderness to die, as many Native Americans used to do, for example, I immediately knew that was wrong for us today. But it's amazing how often we're mistaken. When we jump to conclusions, we need to open our minds, study the facts, listen to opposing views, pray for guidance, and then make a decision. We'll possibly find it wasn't as easy to do as we thought it would be, because finding the truth isn't necessarily easy. We want it to be, of course, and once in a while it is, but usually not. Beware the quick, simple answer, because too often it is merely simplistic rather than correct. Upon observing people who are too eager for the quick fix, Steve often points out that if you think about it, you realize that the more you know about a subject, the more you understand that there are nuances, complicated circumstances, what-ifs, variables. Here's an example I've used before, but I like it. Several of you work with children. Marcy, Lori, Kevin, Billy, Miss Carolyn. You've undoubtedly heard often, What this generation needs is a good trip to the woodshed like we got when I was a kid. That straightened us out pretty darn quick. My guess is you roll your eyes, because even putting aside the ethical issue of whether it's morally right to hit children, you know that disciplining is not that simple. There are children who would be traumatized for life by a switch stinging their bare legs. There are also children who would consider a sound thrashing to be nothing more than an annoying interruption in their pursuit of corruption and mayhem. So you try distracting a child you discover in the early stages of some forbidden activity. One little guy is quickly diverted by the introduction of a different toy or a puzzle. Another tot, who has her mind determinedly set on some forbidden delight, would not be distracted by the arrival of an ice cream truck. A few children are racked with remorse by a slight frown and a little shake of your head. Others find your disapproval to be a good indicator that whatever they are up to is definitely worth pursuing. You also know that you can have children who are putting up with a rough patch at home, children who are malnourished, maybe actually hungry. You may have a child who is a little slow to pick up on what is going on around him, or perhaps Caitlin badly needs her nap. In other words, how to discipline a child does not have an easy, one-size-fits-all answer. The truth is that the appropriate discipline probably varies minute to minute, child to child, and takes training, experience, and patience to get right. So beware the simple answer. Closely related, and also to be wary of, is the fallacy of black and white thinking. Oh, how we are attracted to it. It is so much easier for us if one thing is completely right and the other completely wrong. We don't have to contend with those pesky shades of gray fogging up everything. But the truth is, problem situations are very, very rarely straightforward, yes or no, right or wrong, stay or go. Think of your own life. How many major decisions do we make that we aren't tortured with indecision? Should we get a new vehicle or put a little money into the old one and drive it a while longer? But what if the transmission goes out and it's about due to? Then again, new car payments are outrageous. Plus, there'd be taxes and insurance to consider. So maybe we look into finding a used car. But you don't know what you're getting with a used car. Wait a minute. Perhaps it would be smarter to get a van this time. And so it goes. But eventually you make a decision. You may feel fairly certain that it was the best one under the circumstances, yet you also know it may not have been. With so many variables and what ifs, how could you know for sure? If this kind of gray exists in the decisions we make in our personal lives, why would it not be present in the decisions that need to be made on the world stage? Black and white thinking is too often the refuge of the person who doesn't want to study the issues. This sort of study usually isn't easy. It can be confusing, complicated, and even disturbing. Perhaps we find ourselves leaning a direction we don't want to go, and that's frightening. Perhaps we find ourselves thinking we have an obligation to get as close to the truth as we possibly can. If we succumb to the easy answer, the quick fix, we're shortchanging our responsibilities as Christian citizens and lovers of truth. We quickly become part of the problem rather than the solution. Another mistake we too easily fall into is allowing excess emotionalism to cloud our judgment. True, we are all emotional creatures and we need to be. It's important to know when to be afraid, for example. We want to feel joy, to express sorrow. But when we start letting emotion make our decisions for us, we lose all objectivity. Emotion pounds in our ears so loudly that reason is drowned out completely. This is a dangerous situation. At the worst possible level, it spawns lynch mobs. Jewish synagogues and black churches have been bombed. Muslim mosques torched. We've been watching horrible things in real time on our TV screens this past couple of weeks. Police brutality and murder, looting, rioting, out of control mob violence, and cruelty. We might object that we don't do those horrible things, but if we allow hate or fear or prejudice or envy or bitterness to overwhelm reason, then we are as guilty as if we had. We must not let our indignation blur our vision. We can't let nostalgia for the past or sentimentalism for what could have been drive our decisions for today. We need to be clear-eyed enough to realize what is happening within us and hard-nosed enough to fight down our emotions when they threaten to overcome our judgment. God did not give us minds for nothing. We have to use them to keep our emotions in check. Fortunately, in this fog of swirling emotions and questions, a light shines through, the light that is always shining for us, no matter what our problems and decisions are, and that light is Jesus. God has done something wonderful for us. He has given us Jesus, the light of the world, the fount of all wisdom, the great healer. When we're uncertain which direction to turn or which path to take, we look for him. I'm not saying that the answer will suddenly pop up in neon, but in the looking, we start down the path to truth. It's amazing how often, if we sincerely ask, "What would Jesus do?" the answer does become clear. It should be the mantra of our whole lives. What would Jesus do? What would Jesus say? The more we seek the answer to those two questions, the closer we come to perfect truth. That's why I'm so troubled by the attitude of so many Christians in our country today. Situations arise, words are spoken, and some Christians wiggle and cringe a little and say, "Well, it may not be perfect in all ways, but we need to consider the whole picture." It seems to me that the whole picture, the bottom line, is saving our souls, not saving our country or preserving a way of life. Jesus asked, "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his soul?" We are citizens of heaven first and United States citizens second, and we have to remember it. Not that by setting aside our Christian values, we will in the long run save our country. No nation that turns its back on God can survive. True greatness can only be built on goodness. Which brings me to another matter that is troubling me. We can't forget that we are Christian brothers and sisters either, no matter what we believe about politics. Some issues seem to be so emotionally charged that Christians are allowing their feelings to overcome their judgment. In Matthew 5:25 and following, we're commanded by Jesus not to be angry with a brother or sister, not to call them names. Yet some of us have become so emotionally caught up in a political position that we have forgotten this admonition. You might be tempted to say, "I could never love someone who supports Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez," or, "Anyone who votes for Donald Trump is not my brother." The proper response is, "Yes, you can," and "Yes, they are." God has not made this loving my Christian brother or sister business optional or conditional. He hasn't said we have to accept each other's political positions or whatever is dividing us, but he has said that we have to be loving, caring, and respectful. That means no name calling, no snide remarks, no bitter criticism. We need to start practicing this acceptance and love right away, because it promises to be a lively hot time between now and November 3rd. We must remember we are all made in the image of Christ with his spark in us. Consequently, we can't hate and we can't be hateful. So no matter how wrongheaded you and I may think each other, no matter how passionate we are about an issue, we have to behave civilly towards each other. It is possible to grit and still love someone. God commands it. Related to this, I think, is our temptation to compartmentalize everything in our lives. We have our professional life and our social life and our political life and, oh yes, our church life. It's tidier that way somehow. But God doesn't smile on this. We are His child 24/7. He has soaked into every pore of our body in that baptismal water. We must be seeking His truth to do His will in everything that we think or do. We can't divorce Him from our political position or anything else. Consequently, we need to be on guard against this temptation to compartmentalize our lives. We must dedicate every part of our lives to sharing His light in the world. A commonly seen bumper sticker slogan reads, "Freedom is not free." It's referring to our armed forces and our indebtedness to them for their sacrifices in the cause of liberty. But it is a sentiment that we all should take to heart. If we want our